Night Work. Interview with Dr. Hollis Taylor, Alice Springs, Australia, 11th of October 2024. On my travels to the Australian outback in October 2024, I had the chance to interview Hollis Taylor, a musician, composer, and zoomusicologist, about her unique research on the night songs of the Pied Butcherbird, an ancient songbird native to Australia. I began by asking her about her first encounter with her future research subject.
I had an epiphany on my first trip to Australia. It was in 2001. I was in the deep outback of Western Australia, and I was just walking around looking for a kangaroo, not realizing that they are nocturnal. I was never going to find one during the day. And I heard a jazz flutist in a tree. And I was astounded. And then I realized it was a bird and that there were two other birds and they were singing in a trio. And I didn't know that birds sang in trios. I was completely taken by what they were doing, by the timbre, the sound, which was rich and flute-like. And I made a couple of notations because I have perfect pitch and I've done a lot of transcribing in my life. But my reaction was really more than a composer's bio-inspiration. I really wanted to know what these birds were up to. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And so I went on to study them full-time. In a couple years' time, I had a scholarship, and that's when I embarked on doing my own field work. At first, I didn't know exactly what they sounded like. I'd heard one or two. I didn't really know exactly what they looked like. I had a really steep learning curve I didn't really know how to record them. I didn't really know anything, or how I should record them, how I should annotate. I decided I would try to be as scientific as possible, not realizing that the divide between science and the arts is still very active and that I wouldn't be accepted by many scientists, and also that my questions were really different ones. So I was really interested in what they were doing musically because I felt that they were fellow musicians.
I was wondering who supported her research.
We did a lot of self-supporting. My husband and I, put our funds into my project, but I did have a PhD scholarship, so I had some money, and I had a very small amount for field work, which meant I needed to sleep always in the car. There was never room for a budget that would let me sleep in a cabin or anything like that. So it was hard work because it would be very hot, very humid in North Queensland, and there you are trying to go to bed at 6 o'clock in the afternoon when it's still really hot, and because you've got to get up in the middle of the night because these birds sing nocturnally, the solo songs, and the solo songs is what really interests me. They could sing little snippets during the day, and they could sing duets, especially during the dawn chorus, trios, octets, whatever. But the solo songs are the long songs. They're complex. They recombine elements. They may even do mimicry. And they've never been studied before. And they are a wealth of fascinating musicianship.
Australia is a good place to research birdsong. Eventually, Hollis moved to Alice Springs, one of the homes of the Pied Butcherbird.
So songbirds originated in the supercontinent of Gondwana, which was Australia and New Zealand and Papua New Guinea. And then they radiated out from there. Because all the researchers, or most of them, were from Europe and America, maybe China, everyone assumed, oh, that's where they all came from. But it's not the case. So if we want to know about how birdsong originated, and how songbirds have evolved and developed, we have to look to Australia. And that's quite thrilling to think that this continent, if you think birdsong is music, that this continent could be the origins of music. The pied butcherbird, who I study, is not as old as the lyrebird, who I also study. The lyrebird is one of the oldest, but the pied butcherbird's been on the planet for about 13 million years, which I find just chilling. Lyrebird, much longer. And when you think about lyrebirds as being the world's best mimics in the bird species, that does make you want to reflect on how important mimicry is to music rather than genius, the genius composer.
Let's listen to a recording of the night songs of the pied butcherbird. The voice of the pied butcherbird. In 2017, Hollis Taylor published Is Birdsong Music? A book in which she reflects on her outback encounters with the Australian songbird.
Yes, and it's not the question that I wanted to ask, is birdsong music? What I wanted to ask is, what did that bird just sing? Or what can musicians tell us about birdsong that no one else can, that biologists cannot? And so that's what really interested me and drove me. But I wanted to read as much science as I could about birdsong. And in the process of doing that, I found things that were just wrong. And they were wrong about even just the one species I was studying. So that prompted me to just really compile a list of all the reasons that scientists and even some human musicians give for why birdsong is not music. And then I set about refuting those various arguments. So it forced me to be more of a theorist than I might have wanted to have been.
And with respect to music, is there a particular dispute about the purpose of their singing?
So function is one of the areas where scientists and also other musicians sometimes get tripped up saying birdsong is functional, so it can't be music. Completely missing the fact that musicologists have now for decades been writing books about the many functions of human music. It's not even contested anymore amongst most musicologists and musicians that there are multiple functions. But nonetheless, you read in scientific journals, birdsong is not music because birdsong is functional, whereas, this is almost a direct quote, whereas human music is produced for pure enjoyment. Yawn. So function is one of the areas that I attack in my book. First of all, there's nothing stopping function from also having an aesthetic component. And in fact, it makes sense that any aesthetic component would have also a function because then that's going to encourage it to happen. I mean, if somebody really doesn't want to believe that birdsong is music because they want to believe it's only functional, fine. But usually when I play them a Pied Butcher bird song and then they hear another that's so different, and then I tell them that they can last for up to 6 hours, that is not necessary in order to maintain a territory. There is some extra component. There is some extra vibrancy and verve. There is more that goes far beyond what's necessary to maintain the territory. Most birds in Australia are not migratory, so they're in their territory all year round. They know their neighbors. They've worked out all the arguments, and they pretty much get along. They have to. It's too much energy to waste. So I don't think it's as big of an issue. Competition, I think, is overrated in the animal world. I think also cooperation is a large part of the animal world, and groups and species that are good at cooperating with one another have been quite successful. Pied Butcher birds will sing together and cooperate together, and I think that's an equally strong way to think about it.
In 2017, Hollis Taylor released the double album Absolute Bird, a collection of compositions inspired by and incorporating the night songs of the Pied Butcher Bird. Let's listen to one of them. Own Spring Reserve, 2014, for field recording and vibraphone. We just heard Own Spring Reserve 2014 by Hollis Taylor with Claire Edwards on vibraphone. Listening to her music, I was interested in how she approached her musical interaction with the bird.
Yes, well, I wouldn't do it on site because some people do, not with the Pied Butcher Bird, but some people do play music with birds or at birds, mm-hmm. nightingale or something. I mean, to me, if you're just playing your New York licks back at someone, it's not really like an interchange anyway. So I'm a little dubious of that musical approach, but I'm also dubious of interfering with birds who mainly sing or sing the most during their breeding season. So I would never want to interfere with that. So that's why I wouldn't be interested in performing with them in situ. My own compositions based on their songs, I call them recompositions because I want to give them the credit because they are the composers, they are the artists, and I'm really just transcribing their achievement and celebrating it. And for instance, because they sing for a second or two, followed by several seconds of silence, if we can use that word post-John Cage, but they're not singing. I thought if I just had a violinist, for example, standing there playing for a couple seconds and then silence and then a couple more seconds and then silence, I worried that the human audience would start to, you know, cough or shuffle the program or make some kind of noise and then people get self-conscious. And I didn't want to create that kind of vibe. I wanted it to be more fun and vibrant than that. So I thought, well, I could play their phrases on the violin or somebody else could play them. And then I could put with it my field recordings. And so I have one where I've recorded an auctioneer and cows, and I'm playing with a bird that was recorded near an auction house. I've got others where I'm playing with trucks and honks and car windows and campers, all sorts of things. But the favorite for many people was always when I played with the bird in question. And so I just started playing more and more with various birds. Sometimes I play their phrases at the same time and then alternating and maybe even changing the phrase a little bit, like putting it in retrograde, which is backwards, you know, something like that. But I try not to fool with them too much because I really want to make them famous, not myself, and I want to celebrate their distinct achievement. Their combinatorial ability is really astounding, and I've had number crunchers look at it, and they can't figure out what they're doing. They're like minimalist composers, and you could think of it as like, you know, snap together beads like on a bracelet, and they pull apart the bracelet, and they take out the green motif or the green bead, you know, or the green bead may start the phrase, or it may be in the middle of the phrase, or it may be at the end of the phrase. So they limit their vocabulary to certain motifs each one chooses, and then they expand it by rearranging them. It's somehow repetition with variation, a big tried and true concept for art of all kind.
So I wondered, given the distinct structures of the bird's song, how she combines her field recordings with the acoustic instruments in her compositions.
If it's of an auctioneer with a cow or something like that, that would be edited. I don't have any particular rules that it has to be exactly the way it happened. But if it's the playing with a bird, I don't usually change those at all. The bird's timing is intact, everything about it. is intact and I fit my things around it or to work with it. And also testing it, it's been very instructive. At first I just did, of course, pieces that I was going to play, and then musicians started asking me, would you write me a piece? And it really allows you to test the phrases. Do they just sound beautiful on a flute or a violin because they do sing so beautifully? Or would they sound just as musical three or four octaves lower on a string bass? And so it's been a way of testing bassoon. And of course they do. They sound really musical.
And apart from musicality, Hollis also discovered affinities between bird soloists and human musicians in regard to attributes such as virtuosity and stage presence. Let's hear another of Hollis' compositions. Cumberdine Dam, Thema, for violin and field recording. That was Cumberdine Dam, Thema, for violin and field recording. Violin, Hollis Taylor. Hollis' compositions show that her approach to the Pied Butcher Bird is clearly shaped by her long career as a musician.
I was trained as a classical violinist, but then I became involved in a lot of other things. I became my state fiddle champion. That got me into Western swing and bluegrass. And then I played jazz. And I lived in the Dominican Republic briefly and studied Afro-Cuban music. And I lived in Budapest and collected folk tunes from Eastern Europe. So I was transcribing all of these genres except for classical music, which is written out. I had to do that myself. I had to, and because I have absolute pitch, I was able to do it perhaps easier than some, but I also had to really work to perfect it. Did I master all of those genres? No. But what I did do was I mastered the art of transcription, the art of going into a genre that you know nothing about and starting from square one and making sense of it. I want to make a contribution, and studying the sound world and the music of another species is something that I think a lot of musicians and other people are interested in and will be interested in. So,
at the end of our talk, Hollis read a passage from her book, which gives a fascinating insight into the atmosphere of her night work.
Mount Surprise, North Queensland, 24 October 2013, 2:45 a.m. A fellow musician once told me, "You have 15 seconds to grab your audience." Rousted out of a dream by a Pied Butcherbird's clarion call, I force myself to sit up. I've been grabbed. I immediately turn on my recorder and give an ident, time, place, etc., as I head out. The stage is awash in the light of a three-quarter moon. As clouds file past, it fades to dark. I've dragged my camp chair with me, so I take a seat in the nightclub, the only human audience in an unfolding spectacle of light and dark, sound and silence. The moonlight soon returns. Those sizable birds flying regularly overhead, who are they out at night? I expect the typical nocturnal ones, but some profiles match those of diurnal birds like kookaburras, kites, currawongs, black cockatoos, and straw-necked ibis. The Pied Butcherbird takes four different song posts in the course of a nearly three-hour virtuoso performance, drawing a song circle around me. "Auditory space has no point of favored focus," wrote D.C. Williams. He was right, but not about tonight. I'm in the middle, favored. Each scene has a different wash from our ancient luminaire. Even when the moonlight is at its most intense, the light is soft. My brain never gets enough information to be a reliable witness. It cannot confirm revelation of form, and I sometimes fall victim to shape-shifting objects. Attentive to the slightest detail, I'm riveted by the fluid theatricality. It's a free improv session, and anything could happen. No cars, roosters, generators, or people disrupt. Crickets pulse, the one constant. Wallabies crash through the bush. A rabbit sneaks by me, provoking a large pair of wings to fly in the bunny's direction. Some bird silhouettes float noiselessly past like shadow puppets. A small grevillea tree drops an occasional flower, releasing a fragrance of honeysuckle blossoms set on a bale of herbaceous hay. At 5:15, a mosquito jerks me out of my trance and warns that the nocturnal song is almost over. A kookaburra gives a forced laugh for a joke that didn't quite come off. Then several mount a proper chuckle. Next are the alarm birds, who concoct frequency sweeps like car alarms. Suddenly, I'm in a raucous parking lot. A few new insects add pizzazz. The Pied Butcherbird begins to fade out, truncating phrases and leaving longer and longer intervals of silence between them, while the chirpers, trillers, and squawkers come to dominate the sonic space. Sun's up. Show's over.
Night work. Dr. Hollis Taylor interviewed by Kirsten Glandin in October 2024 in Alice Springs, Central Australia. Production, Elsen Studio Berlin, 2025.